Stephen Levitt is not your garden variety economist. His CV includes degrees from Harvard and MIT, a tenured position in the economics department at the University of Chicago, and the John Bates Clark Medal, awarded every 2 years to the most outstanding American economist under 40. So why is he studying corruption in a wide range of subjects, some of them rather unorthodox, like high-stakes school testing and sumo wrestling? Well, now this self-described rogue economist has written a book about it called Freakonomics. It is co-written with Stephen J. Dubner and published by William Morrow, and I'm very pleased it has brought Stephen Levitt to my show today. Hello.
Hey, thanks for having me here.
The subtitle of the book claims you explore, I'm quoting, the hidden side of everything. Can the hidden side of everything be revealed?
Well, not everything.
I was getting worried.
Yeah, but
there are a few things I don't want anybody to know about.
But, you know, we take the tools of economics, and what we do with them is apply them places other people, I don't know if they're afraid to go, but they don't go. And sometimes we turn up stuff I think is pretty interesting.
Well, most people assume that an economist looks at questions related to money. So is your work really economics? Is economics a body of information or a set of techniques?
Yeah, I think of economics as being a toolkit. It's a worldview. It's a way of answering questions. So we have great empirical methods, great ways to use data. And also, we have an approach which is, you know, we look for the answer to questions. We don't worry about what's right or wrong. We don't worry about the morality of the answers we come up with. We simply follow the facts where they go and try and describe the world as it is.
But since economic predictions are often so wrong, hasn't it been called the most unscientific of all the sciences?
I'm not sure any of the scientists are as scientific as people think they are. I think much of science is art, storytelling. I think the interesting parts, it's about ideas. And I think the division between science and non-science is an artificial one.
You say that conventional wisdom is often wrong. I've always wondered about when it was ever right. It was originally invented as a kind of pejorative by John Kenneth Galbraith, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So Galbraith coined the term. Really, with what you're saying, what you have in mind is that the conventional wisdom was what people believed because it was easy, because it was convenient, as opposed to what's true. And, you know, I think, honestly, conventional wisdom more often than not is right.
It's true.
You know, it's some things are, you know, true, they make sense, they're obvious. And part of the art or the skill of what I do is to try to figure out what conventional wisdoms are wrong, so I can spend my time attacking the ones that are wrong rather than, tilting against windmills for the ones that are right.
Well, you have a controversial theory about why crime declined in the second half of the 1990s. We've heard three or four explanations. Rudy Giuliani the broken windows thing, demographics, suddenly there were fewer young people. What are your reasons?
Well, not everyone agrees with me, but I think the evidence is quite compelling that the biggest reason why crime fell in the 1990s was actually the legalization of abortion in the 1970s. Okay? And that's not a thesis many people like to hear. It's one, you know, it doesn't matter where you are on the political spectrum. It's like a punch to the belly when you first hear this idea. But I think it's actually a pretty straightforward, simple theory. The theoretical basis is as follows. There are really only two pieces into the theory. The first one is that unwanted children are at a higher risk for crime. And there's 50 years of social scientific research which documents the fact that if your mother doesn't love you, then life is going to be tough. One of the ways life will be tough is in terms of higher risk for criminality. The second piece of the puzzle of the theory is that after the legalization of abortion, there were fewer unwanted children born.
But abortion was legalized in the mid-60s, and the 1985 was a pretty high crime time.
Okay, so New York was on the cutting edge of legalized abortion. Late 69 is when it became legal in New York. And so you expect that there will be something like a 20-year lag, even a 25-year lag before the full effects of abortion are felt. So, in fact, the time series pattern, the timing is right. Now, the tricky thing that really makes it hard to test this theory in the data is crack cocaine. Because crack cocaine is the 800-pound gorilla that comes from out of nowhere in 1985 and has a dramatic effect. So, young black male homicides between 1985 and 1990 quintupled. And really, it was really at the end, like at the peak of crack, was right the age when the first cohorts that had been exposed to legalized abortion were coming of age in terms of crime. And so, but if you just track those same individuals over their whole life, so even though they were teenagers at the peak of crack, if you look over their whole life, they actually did a lot less crime than the cohorts that were born just before them, surprisingly.
My guest is Stephen D. Levitt, who teaches economics at the University of Chicago. His book, Freakonomics, A Rogue Economist Explains the Hidden Side of Everything, written with Stephen J. Dubner, is published by William Morrow. This is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. Well, you also studied the business practices of a crack gang. Does one thing lead you to another?
You're saying in terms of my research?
Yeah. You were thinking about crack in terms of the lowering crime rate, and then you wind up talking to a crack gang.
Exactly. So the crack gang was really a fortunate event. My co-author on that project was Sudhir Venkatesh, who's a professor in sociology at Columbia, and he had devoted roughly the last 5 to 10 years of his life living with the crack gang, living in housing projects, doing research. And I had the good fortune to stumble onto Sudhir, have a short conversation with him. It became apparent he had data, and Sudhir gave me the data. I sat at my computer typed into an Excel spreadsheet, and we were able to say a lot of things about a crack gang that no one's been able to say, because no one's ever had the data before or since. Has anyone been able to get access to the actual financial records of a crack gang and how they operate?
And one of the things that you came up with is that low-level dealers make the equivalent of minimum wage. We always thought that those guys were rolling in dough.
Yeah, at the top of the gang, there's a lot of money, that the people at the top are paid well. It's in fact, the gang is remarkably like a modern American corporation. The guys at the top are doing very well. The guys at the bottom are doing minimum wage. And the only way to get from the top, from the bottom to the top, is to work your way up. And so the difference between the gang and a typical modern corporation is the incredible risk that the people at the bottom face. So the street-level sellers were actually dying in our time period we were looking at a rate of almost 7% per year, which is far higher than soldiers in Iraq. I mean, I think you have to go back to something like airplane, you know, fighter pilots in World War II to find death rates like that. I mean, literally, there was a war in the inner city. There was like war on the streets.
Well, you say economics is fundamentally concerned with incentives. So the incentives for these kids, despite all of the dangers and the low pay, was that eventually they might wind up on top?
Exactly. I think that the situation in the crack gang is not so different than a situation in a law firm, for instance. The first year lawyers who are hired work very hard. They get paid okay, but they would never do it if they knew that they were going to be first year associates for the rest of their lives. They would never do it. They're doing it because they want to move up the ladder to be partners. It's the same as the homecoming queen who goes out to Hollywood, waits tables for 7 years trying to get a break. The only way to get up to the top of this gang was to start at the bottom, and it was a way out. There weren't very many options for the low-level sellers, and it wasn't actually ex ante. It wasn't a crazy choice to make.
Where were they of the possibility that they would be killed?
I think
are not going to be killed. They may be stressed out.
I think they were very aware of the risks of death. They had been living in the neighborhoods, and they, this was their life. Now, what happened was the gang really changed with crack. Before crack, gangs were peer groups. They were a way of protecting turf, of kind of aging through the adolescence. When crack came, it transformed the gang because it became a viable business. There was enough money that you could stick around and make a career out of it. Now, the thing was, what the low-level gang members in the early crack years failed to realize was how the landscape had changed. And so it turned out, it used to be that when you got to be 21, 22, you dropped out of the gang. So the low-level gang members, they're thinking, well, I'm 17, in 5 years I'll be running the gang. But it never happened. The same gang leaders who were running the gang in 1985, because this became so profitable, are still hanging on today. And so it was really very much like we say in the book, it was like the internet bubble, where the first movers made a ton of money, then everybody dropped out of business school, And then you had the pets.com where you invested a ton of money and everybody lost it. And that's really, the crack gang ended up being a lot like, the late comers to crack were a lot like pets.com.
Let's talk a bit about cheating by public school teachers. Why did that happen?
Well,
and how does economics fit into
that? Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's all about incentives. Okay, so we understand why third graders might want to cheat on their exams to do better, or you might want to cheat on your SAT. So you might say, well, why do the teachers want to cheat on these exams for the students? And I think there are two kinds of incentives. There's the indirect incentives, the pride, the reward of teaching the right classes. And I think that was one of the early reasons why teachers cheated. But then what also happened, this is in Chicago, is a heavy emphasis on high-stakes testing, that schools would be punished if their students didn't well, individual teachers might be punished, and also children would be held back if they didn't do well. They got rid of social promotion. And so as a consequence, the stakes of these tests went way up. Now, what didn't change was the way the tests were administered, which were in the classrooms with very little proctoring, and indeed the teachers were even encouraged to go over the exams after the test to get rid of stray marks, because the emphasis on getting high scores was so great that they really wanted to make sure they didn't miss out any correct answers.
So teachers were being encouraged by administrators to help in any way they could, perhaps.
Yeah, so
at least that's what the teachers were assuming from the hints they were getting.
Well, so it's really a case where these tests didn't used to matter, and so they weren't very careful about how they were administered. Then they started to matter. It would be an insult to take them out of the classroom. It would be suggesting the teachers were cheating. And so as a consequence, there was just very lax supervision, and nobody really had ever tried to catch them. So for years and years, teachers could cheat with complete impunity. And
how were they caught?
Well, unfortunately, an egghead, namely me, got the idea that maybe it would be interesting to try to figure out whether the incredible increases they had in Chicago test scores might have been linked to cheating. Now, it turns out that hypothesis was actually wrong, that although there was a lot of cheating, in essence, there had always been a lot of cheating, even before the high-stakes testing came in, and so it wasn't actually affecting the test scores. But so what we did is we had piles of data. We had every test taken over a seven-year period by every student in the Chicago public elementary schools, and we tried to devise algorithms, ways of detecting the hidden sort of contrails of cheating in these exams. And we're not talking about subtle cheating, like giving a little extra time or teaching to the test. We're talking about actually teachers or administrators going into the exams, erasing the bubbles that the students had filled in, and putting in their own answers.
So that was the difference between the cheating that had occurred earlier, that now the cheating would be haphazard in the past. Now there seemed to almost be a conscious effort to raise the test scores.
Well, I think that had been going on for a long time. Even before there were any real financial incentives, we found evidence that about 2-3% of the classrooms had teacher or administrator cheating. Now, after they raised the stakes, we found that that jumped to about 5% of the classrooms. And what's interesting, and I think telling, is that the cheating didn't change at all among the very successful schools, the schools that were not on the margin. But the ones who really could get into trouble, that's exactly where we saw the changes. And we also didn't see very much change in cheating regarding the students and the students being held back. Because one answer you could say is, well, this is civil disobedience on the part of the teachers. They thought that was a bad rule. They're just cheating to help the students. But, you know, like most people, the cheaters were helping to help. The teachers were cheating to help the teachers, just as most people are. When they cheat, they're cheating to help themselves, not other people.
So that was their ultimate incentive.
Right.
My guest is Stephen D. Levitt. He and Stephen J. Dubner, they spell their Stephens differently. Mr. Levitt's is with a V, Mr. Dubner with a PH. The book, Freakonomics, A Rogue Economist, being Mr. Levitt, explores the hidden side of everything. It is published by William Morrow. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Stephen D. Levitt, L-E-V-I-T-T. His book, Freakonomics, A Rogue Economist, explores the hidden side of everything, written with the help of Stephen J. Dubner, is published by William Morrow. So we've been talking about some serious policy issues and some major criminal problems, but you apply this approach to a lot of different things. Sumo wrestlers, realtors, what gets you interested in a certain topic?
Yeah, I just follow my nose. Whatever interests me, I go after, and I've never worried about whether anybody else was going to care about the answers. And in fact, I've always been stunned when people have cared. The sumo wrestling piece in particular, I just did it almost at the lark. I thought it was interesting. I've wanted to study corruption for a long time, but it's just so hard because, unlike other subjects, the topic of the study spend a lot of time and effort making sure that you can't actually catch them doing it. And so it really is a challenge to try to figure out who's cheating, who's corrupt. And sumo wrestling gave me an avenue into that because someone's keeping score. And when someone keeps score, it leaves a trail, leaves a record that I could follow.
Well, how can you decide whether somebody has really fallen because of the strength of the opponent or because he's allowed himself to fall?
That's where data comes in. Data allow you to answer this question, which on the surface you'd say, how can this American who knows very little about sumo wrestling, how will he ever convincingly say that sumo wrestlers were cheating? So I'll pitch it to you. Tell me whether it's convincing or not. I have to tell you just a little bit about sumo wrestling to set the stage for it. So in sumo wrestling, they have tournaments in which there are 15 matches. Each wrestler wrestles once a day for 15 days. And the key point is the incentive systems they have. They have rankings there, just like we have NCAA basketball rankings. And the ranking means everything to the life of the sumo wrestler. And how you perform in the tournaments determines whether or not you move up or down the ranking. In particular, having a winning record, that eighth win, going from 7 wins to 8 wins, is incredibly important. For any other win, on average, the sumo wrestler will gain 3 points in the ranking. For that win, it's worth 12 points in the ranking. So what you have is, on the last day, a situation where if one wrestler has 7 wins and 7 losses, another wrestler has, say, 8 wins and 6 losses, the wrestler who has the 7 wins has a lot more to gain by winning than the wrestler who already has the 8 wins has to gain by winning. And so there are the gains from trade, and an economist might think they'll figure out a way to make sure that the right wrestler wins, and there'll be some compensation of one form or another. And indeed, if you look at the data, the right wrestler does win on that last day over 75% of the time.
What about the wrestler who has a losing record, a guaranteed losing record? Is he more likely to just allow himself to lose again?
So he as well. So if you have only 6 wins going into the final day and you're wrestling another wrestler with 7, sure, you're willing to lose. There's more for the other guy to gain. Now, not willing, you need to be compensated. So the one question is, though, how can you know that? The wrestler who has 7 wins, he also has a lot bigger incentive to try harder. It could just be effort. And that's where the data really help us, because one thing you can see is when two wrestlers meet again, after they've met, when one of them really needs a win, a surprising thing happens. The wrestler who really needed that eighth win often gets it, more often than he should. The next time those same two wrestlers face off, it turns out the wrestler who needed the win last time loses far more often than he should. And it's very hard to come up with another theory other than this sort of quid pro quo to explain it. Now, on top of that...
So what does that mean to the sumo wrestlers? Did when this was revealed, was there a big scandal in the sumo wrestling world?
Well, the Japanese media is quite different from the American media. There was never a ripple of attention paid to what we did. In fact, we taped an interview with Radio 1 in Tokyo, which has an English language radio, which has over 1 million listeners. And we never got a single comment from anyone, which made us highly suspicious that it had ever run. And I think it's just been viewed as something that the Japanese media doesn't want to talk about.
One of the fundamental power differentials you talk about is the power of information. Why shouldn't we trust experts?
Well, experts are people, and people try to do the best they can for themselves. And oftentimes, what's best for the expert is not best for the client.
But so, you're an expert, aren't you?
Not everyone would call me an expert. I'd like to think I'm an expert on some things, but I think that's exactly right. So you want to think, when you listen to me, you should be thinking,
yeah, what are your incentives?
What are my incentives? So one incentive I have is I want to sell this book, so I want to sound interesting. So I'm trying to make the book sound more interesting than it really is. But
no, it's an interesting book.
But, you know, think about it. So we know experts can't be trusted, right? Car mechanics. Everybody thinks of car mechanics and worries about their incentives. What we tend to think less about are other kinds of experts, whether it's doctors, real estate agents. I think we tend to swallow, you know, hook, line, and sinker the kind of advice that doctors and realtors give us. We don't think with the same clarity as we do about, say, lawyers.
Now, what incentive does a doctor have for lying to us?
Well, one particular case that's been shown, it's not my research, it's research done by John Gruber at MIT, is they looked at the rate at which cesarean sections were performed. And it turned out that C-sections were a lot more common in places where there weren't very many babies being born relative to the number of OBGYNs. And so it seemed that when there wasn't a lot of business, the doctors pumped it up a little bit in terms of cost by doing C-sections. That'd be one example.
You also tie real estate agents with the Ku Klux Klan.
Well, in the sense that both real estate agents and the Ku Klux Klan are very effective at using their private information, their specialized information, to their own advantage to achieve the goals they want. In the case of realtors, the incentive scheme is set up in such a way that it's really skewed so that on the margin, the home seller stands to make a lot more money from holding out for better offer from the realtor. So the 6% realtor's fee, that's split between the buyer and the seller's realtor. And then that's split again between the realtor and their company. So the realtor only gets 1.5% of any extra they can get on your house. So another $10,000 for your house, which the seller cares a lot about, that's only $150 for the realtor. And so if that means a bunch of house showings, a lot of extra time, more advertising, you can see why the realtor might be eager to get you to settle for a slightly less good offer.
So if the realtor says, take the offer, it's the best you're going to get, it's the first offer you got, you should be suspicious.
Well, you should think twice, and what you should really do is your own research. You should know what your house is worth. You should go to open houses, what your apartment's worth. You should know the market and know whether or not the realtor is providing you the service that you deserve.
You suggest that parents are extremely important to their children for who they are, not really for what they do. What do you mean by that?
Well, what we mean is using this incredible new data set that the Department of Education has been gathering on 10,000 children over the last 5 or 6 years, we have very detailed information about the home environments and the school outcomes of children up to the age of third grade. And what we see is that the kinds of activities children do, so whether your parents read to you, how often you go to the museum, things of that nature just don't correlate highly with how children do in school. What does correlate are things like whether your parents are well-educated, how many books you have in the home, interestingly. So it's this ironic situation where having a lot of books in the home matters, but reading them to your children doesn't seem to matter, which certainly seems like a paradox. And I think the answer is that the kind of house, the kind of household, the kind of environment in which there are a lot of children's books in the home is one that is nurturing, it fosters, that you can believe in education.
So even if the one family is very wealthy and the other one is very poor, the child of the poor family where there are a lot of books might very well wind up doing better, or does it want to be an equalizer?
Well, wealthy helps too. So don't get me wrong. Being wealthy doesn't hurt at all. Being older parents also helps with the children doing better in school. Now, of course, there's enormous amount of variation, and in no way am I saying that a young mother's child who doesn't have a lot of books won't do well in school. This is on average. With enormous variation.
Genes also play a part in all of this.
Presumably.
And the child's own personality.
Absolutely. But overall, it really, what it seems is that home environments matter, not by the specific activities, whether you have baby Einstein tapes playing while the child's in utero, Sort of the way I think about it is that it's sort of like a stress reliever for parents. You don't have to have your kid going to every program in class. It just doesn't seem to be any evidence that matters. Stay-at-home moms, it doesn't seem to matter whether the mother works or stays at home with the child.
You also have looked into the things that might be dangers in a child's life, and they turn out to not always be the things we think of as dangerous.
That's right. So from the perspective of a child dying, if you compare a home that has a gun and a swimming pool, it turns out that statistically the swimming pool is 100 times more likely to kill the child than the gun.
You lost a child, so you probably have thought a bit about how children die, but you didn't lose your kid to a swimming pool or a gun.
No, my child died of meningitis.
Uh-huh. And are there any statistics that can be done on that when kids come in contact with dangerous illnesses?
Well, one of the beauties of modern times is that childhood death is just incredibly rare. I mean, that's been the greatest success of medicine, far more than in prolonging life, for 60, 70, 80-year-olds. It's really preventing early death of children. It's just been an incredible advance. And so although I was one of the incredibly unfortunate people to suffer that, in general, it's just gotten, I mean, the safest years of life, the single safest year of life is the year from 1 to 2. And that's exactly, that happened to be the year when my child died. But
the single safest year because the kid is seeing a pediatrician on regular basis.
Oh, I don't know. I'm not sure those pediatrician visits are doing anything at all. I think what makes it safe is that if you were robust enough to survive the first year and all the traumas that come with birth, there just aren't many things that put you at risk when you're young.
We were talking about books as one of the factors of future success. You said that names actually are great predictors.
Well, not exactly. I'm one of the few who actually believes that names do not have a causal impact on your life. So there have been studies done.
I mean, if your name is Kosnowski and your name is Jones, it's pretty much the same thing?
We find in our research that names just don't matter at all for your life outcomes. Now, this stands in contrast to other research. So other people have sent out resumes that have, typically African-American names and typically white names, exact same resumes other than the name on them. And they find there are fewer callbacks for the black resumes than the white resumes. We take a very different approach. We actually look at the birth records of every child born in California since 1960. And what we can do is link up when a child is born, and there's a lot of information on the birth certificate about the parents and the location you live, and then link to when the woman herself gives birth again 20 or 30 years later and see what kind of life she lives. So what we do is we essentially pair up children, babies who are born, who look identical on paper in 1965 or 1970, except that one is given a distinctively black name, one's given a traditionally white name, and then we look at what their outcomes are. And so what we find among African-American children, the name just doesn't matter. So the life outcomes, the overall life outcomes are unrelated once you control for other factors. Now, there are differences in who chooses to give their child a distinctively black name versus a traditionally white name. But once you control for those underlying factors, like the age of the parents and whatnot, the name itself doesn't seem to matter. So names are correlated with outcomes, but there's, in our research, absolutely no causal link between those two.
So that would suggest that racism is not really a problem for blacks in America. If you call up, if you're looking for a job or trying to rent an apartment and your name is one of the new names that we hear a lot in the African-American community, you're as likely to get a fair hearing as somebody whose name is Stephen D. Levitt?
No, so that's not an implication you can take from the research, because let's think. So when you send in your resume, so I think you're a lot less likely, if you have a distinctively black name, to get that interview. But the point is, if racism presumably is the reason that you didn't get the interview, well, you get a much clearer signal of someone's race when they show up for the interview. You get to see them. You know their race. And so actually, I think that our research says nothing about whether racism is active. What our research really says is that people have much better signals about your race or other characteristics that you have that come from looking at you rather than hearing your name. And so it's actually, in some ways, if you think about you, there's an employer who's racist and will not hire an African-American. The best circumstance you can have if you're African-American, is to have a distinctively black name, so you don't have to waste a day, take a day off from your other job, to go down to interview for an interview. As soon as the employer sees you, the employer knows he won't want to hire you.
Now, we've heard again and again how statistics can be distorted to make any kind of case that you want. How do you work things out so that doesn't happen in your work?
Well, I think I start by not being political. So I've managed to offend, probably even in this interview, people from all sides and all sides of issues. And I think it helps to not go in with an agenda. I'm not trying to prove that, guns are good or swimming pools are bad. I mean, it's not what I'm about. The other thing is I've got a reputation in my profession, And I've got to be careful to uphold that. You know, if I start saying things that can be proved by others not to be true, it's very costly to me. So in that sense, I'm one of those experts who actually does have the right incentive to say things that are true.
Are there other economists now joining you in this approach?
Well, it's interesting because many of the most successful young economists have actually been devoting their study to issues outside the normal realm of economics, whether it's education, housing and urban issues, issues of race. So I really think that it's a great time, a boom time for economics, for careful study, trying to take really the more interesting questions that got dealt to psychology and to sociology, then got dealt to economics. But we've got a good set of tools, and we're trying to contribute to these other academic fields with a unique new approach.
What did your co-author, Stephen J. Dubner, contribute to this? He's been here to talk about one of his books. I think it was Turbulent Souls. He's also written Confessions of a Hero Worshipper, and people will recognize his name from the New York Times and the New Yorker.
Yeah, Dubner is an absolute genius. He's an incredible writer. He has fantastic ideas. He is actually becoming a really good economist as well. And, you know, we work together really closely in this book, and many of the ideas are his, and you know, the taking my ideas and making them sound beautiful on the page is absolutely something that never in a million years could I have done. And it was just a great partnership. It was so much fun writing the book, and our hope is kind of like that fun comes through when you read it, because it really is trying to be that.
What will inspire a study? Just reading something in the newspaper or seeing somebody else's study that doesn't seem to work for you?
Yeah, I just spend my life wandering around, staring at things, looking for puzzles to try to solve. And so it's, you know, sometimes it's the newspaper, sometimes it'll be an idle conversation over lunch. Sometimes it's, you know, pastimes I have, like, you know, betting on sports, which you know, lead me to have observations about interesting research.
Does it ever lead to dead ends?
Oh, I would say at least 9 out of 10 of my projects end up in the trash barrel.
Stephen D. Levitt teaches economics at the University of Chicago. He recently received the John Bates Clark Medal, awarded every 2 years for the best American economist under 40. His book, Freakonomics, written with Stephen J. Dubner, is published by William Morrow, and I want to thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thank you.
I'll be back tomorrow, same time and same station, when we will try to finally disentangle the complicated mess that was Enron. And then we'll spend the rest of the show celebrating spring. First, a look at the strategy, heartbreak, and joy of baseball with Tony La Russa. Plus, now that the sun is out and the birds are finally singing again, on this week's Please Explain, find out why birds sing and what they're really saying. This show is produced by Melissa Egan with Maureen McMurray, Brenna Farrell, and Sarah English. We had help today from Barbara Kahn and Jessica Bauman. George Edwards was at the audio controls along with Aaron Cohen. Our original theme music is by They Might Be Giants, and I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. I'll see you tomorrow.